Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Morris Manning writes poems about turnips and copperheads and tire swings and a woman who gets her apron strings caught in an old wringer washer. His work is dug from the ground of the Kentucky farmland where he lives, but it's also elevated, universal, as high and expansive as the stars. Manning was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for an earlier book of poems called The Common Man. He's got a new book out just this week called Rail Splitter, which is a series of poems written in Abraham Lincoln's voice from beyond the grave. It's a tribute to another plain-spoken man with visions of something bigger. Here's my conversation with Morris Manning. So, Morris Manning, you're a poet. We don't have poets on here too often, so I feel like it's the right thing to do to start with a poem. Have you got something for us?
Yes, sir, I do. From the new book, Rail Splitter, and the title of this poem is called "You Sockdologizing Old Man Trap," and that's not an ordinary title for a poem, but it's apparently the last line heard on stage at Ford's Theater the night that Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. Ironically, the play that he and his wife were seeing was a comedy. You sockdologizing old man trap. I was laughing hard when the bullet entered my mind, an abrupt idea lodging there unfinished, and I had brayed like a donkey earlier in the play. Following such misery and discord, it was a pleasure to hear laughter, to hear the uproar of the audience and feel my hand involuntarily reach out and clap my knee as if it now again belonged to me. Tragedy divides and turns on willful moral division, but comedy unifies by accident, and the restoration of order is a surprise. And so, by accident, I was united for a moment, for a little span of time.
That's wonderful, Moritz. I guess this is an obvious sort of silly, dumb question that always gets asked in these moments, but how did that idea come into your mind?
In doing the basic research and field that I knew I needed to do for this book, I learned very early on how much Lincoln enjoyed theater. And I started thinking, what would his early experiences of theater likely have been, particularly in his before going to Washington, and I reminded myself of a scene in Huckleberry Finn where Huck is on the raft and these two backwoods actors show up and they do kind of country shows where they recite Shakespearean soliloquies and things like that. And there's a hilarious scene in the novel where the two actors botch together four or five different Shakespeare speeches, and it's just a totally over the top, doesn't make any sense presentation. And I imagine that's the sort of early experience Lincoln would have had seeing anything that we would consider to be refined entertainment. I bet his early experience of theater was pretty primitive. And so at Ford's Theater in Washington, he was sitting in what was at the time of almost brand new theater that had, you know, the most advanced technologies of the day. He was seeing a comedy just weeks after the Civil War was officially over. And I find that the clash of those historical facts to underline what I've always felt to be just one of the ironies of American history, and that the last line he heard made him laugh.
And I know this is a whole sort of suite or collections of poems, not just about Lincoln, but written in Lincoln's voice, and I think you specifically say written in the posthumous voice of Lincoln. So first of all, why Lincoln? And then secondly, why from that perspective?
My second book is in the voice of Daniel Boone. It's called A Companion for Owls. And I, early on in my writing career, I just decided I wanted to imagine American history and a figure who had been fascinating to me since I was a little boy. And probably somewhere in working on the Daniel Boone book, I started realizing, well, there's this other figure associated with Kentucky history, and his name is Abraham Lincoln, and you're probably going to have to confront that history one of these days. The reason I'm from Kentucky, and I live 30 miles from where he spent his early childhood, and we live in the same county in Kentucky where his parents were married. So, and he struck me as someone who was really thoughtful about theater and poetry. And all of those things mattered to him, not just in his sort of self-guided education, but in his conduct as an attorney and then later as a president. For him to be thinking about the quote-unquote art of poetry made sense on a literal level to me from a historical perspective, but also on a more metaphorical level, that as I was working on this book, I began to realize that our history, our national history, is in its way profoundly poetic. And Lincoln's ghost haunts our history. And for him to see our history as our poetry seemed kind of from a beyond the grave perspective, that seemed to have an angle that I could work with.
When you say our history is poetic, what do you mean by that?
In that it's full of ambiguity. And a good poem doesn't leave matters cleanly resolved. A good poem leaves us maybe waiting for the other foot to fall, something like that, or in a state of uncertainty. And I think particularly our history around the Civil War. From what I've read, there were efforts for years to, you know, prevent any sort of civil conflict. And yet, at the same time, there were efforts that were making that conflict inevitable.
Well, you know, obviously you're a Southerner, and so am I, and this podcast is sort of about the South and the pull that it exerts on people. Do you feel that poetic sense is enhanced because of the South's position in the Civil War and the outcome with the South losing the Civil War and the way we've tried to reconcile those things since.
Yeah, those are some deep things to ponder. Yet another irony of our national history, and it's therefore part of our regional history. Lincoln was born in a slave state, and yet it's a state that did not secede, and Lincoln had to leave the South, and yet he married a woman whose family was a very prominent Southern family and slaveholding family, and I think knew perhaps as well as anyone the paradoxes of our history. At least my experience of being a Southerner, it doesn't make the paradoxes easier to bear or understand, but it does bring one closer to them. And I think at least that is a reality I'm grateful for.
What was your family life like growing up? Yeah, my memory from doing some reading was that your family has deep roots in the country, but by the time you came along, your family was sort of in town, right?
Yeah, my like many people of his generation, my dad was raised on a farm in southeastern Kentucky, but it coincided with the Depression. And about the end of World War II, he and his dad and his grandmother moved to Lexington and lived in a one-room apartment. My dad was not terribly articulate about these things, but I understood in my childhood that having to suddenly leave the farm and be in a totally different setting was traumatizing for my dad. I don't know exactly what clarified my view of these matters, but in my childhood I understood that it was my obligation to return my family to the land.
Now, one of the things I remember reading about you and hearing about you is when you were growing up is that you used to tote a tape recorder around and sort of tell stories into that as you sort of walked around in the world. How did that come about, and what came out of that? What kind of stories would you tell?
This is one of those things, you know, at the time, it just you don't understand the significance, and you might spend years before you kind of something clicks and you understand an earlier experience. When I was 8, my grandparents gave me a portable tape recorder, which in those days was a sizable object. And I just got into the habit of putting batteries in it and putting an empty cassette in and then walking into the woods, press record, and I'd just start making up a story. Lots of times I was, as a youngster, really interested to read about fur trappers and pioneers and mountain men and that sort of part of our history. And so I would pretend to be Kit Carson or someone like that. And then if my dog was with me, he was suddenly challenged by a bear or something like that. And I would then go home, and that night I would listen to it. As in lieu of bedtime reading, I would listen to the tape. And I don't know how long. I can't remember how long I did that, but it was important to be doing it. And I would make like sound effects and dramatize it as much as I could, given the limited technology. And I think that there is something in that experience that I still practice in writing poetry. And I think really partly it was just, you know, the adventure of making up a story, which is always fun to this day. But then hearing a voice telling a story, as I would do in the evenings and before going to bed, that the cadence and the sound of a speaking voice is something I think about when I write poems today.
And where in there did the love of poetry or the being drawn toward poetry, when did that start?
I think even early on, I just had an attraction to making up little wordplay games, rhyming, even making up gibberish words. I was fascinated by, shall we say, some bawdy things that a boy might hear occasionally, that kind of a little dirty rhyme of some sort. I heard plenty of those. I can't repeat any of them. But I can tell you something that my dad used to say, and I'm sure it didn't originate with him. In fact, it's probably a variation of a verse from Turkey in the Straw or something like that. But he used to say, I had a little chick that wouldn't lay an egg, poured hot water up and down its leg. The little chick cried and the little chick begged and the little chick laid me a hard-boiled egg. And that's, yeah, I'm sure I was not in school when he first said that to me, and he probably heard it when he was a little boy. So just the fact that language could be arranged into rhythm and rhyme and be funny and witty, that just got me from an early age.
When we come back, Morris Manning talks about how he walks in the woods to see like a poet and also to hear like one. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Each week on Southbound, we take a moment to highlight our listeners. This week, I want to thank Robin Williams, whose Twitter bio says, "Not that one," for tweeting this about the last episode of Southbound. Quote, "Just listen to the interview with Rhiannon Giddens this afternoon. Stellar. I'm a huge fan of you both." Thank you, Robin. And thanks to everyone else who shared and commented on this episode. If you'd like to be a part of the Southbound community, we'd love to hear from you. You can suggest ideas for future guests on our homepage at wfae.org/southbound. You can reach me directly at ttomlinson@wfae.org, or you can tweet at me at Tommy Tomlinson. What really helps is if you subscribe to Southbound on the NPR One app. That helps NPR get the word out to even more listeners. Thanks for all your support. Now, back to our conversation with Morris Manning. When did you figure out that being a poet is something you could do and that it's something you wanted to do?
Well, I was late to the game. And as far as that goes, I believe, a sophomore or junior in college before I realized that poetry is still written. When I was in high school and such, the poets that we studied in school were all dead, and mostly white men too. Nobody explicitly said so, but I just concluded, well, I guess nobody writes poetry anymore. That it all ended when Robert Frost died or something like that. even then, when I was in college, we read dead writers. We did not read anyone who was alive. And then one day in my, I was taking a poetry survey course, and a little wire-haired woman showed up in the class, and she, our professor handed around a few sheets of mimeographed poems, and I quickly figured out that these poems were written by this woman who was unexpectedly visiting our class, and her name was Denise Levertov, who's been dead several years now, but she was originally born in England and became an American citizen, and was an important poet of her generation in the 50s and 60s and 70s. It was just a complete epiphany. I looked at this fairly petite woman who didn't seem to be anybody special, but by gosh, she was writing poems. And she was charming and very down to earth, and I thought, it's possible.
Your folks came from the land and were farmers and all that sort of thing over the years. When you came back home and said, I'm going to be a poet, at whatever point you did that, how did your family react to that?
Well, my grandmother, my dad's mother, I can remember telling her I wanted to study poetry, and she said, well, I don't know why you don't want to go into law or medicine. And she was from an era where, you know, if you wanted to improve yourself or you know, raise your station, being a doctor or a lawyer was a acceptable path to take. My dad, he passed away in 2015. So I got, 5 books done before he died, and he was able to be proud. However, I don't think he ever read anything that I wrote. I don't mean this unkindly, but I never saw him read a book in my life of any kind. And yet he is the parent who was most colorful with his use of language. So I attribute his influence to my early interest in just the play of language.
Did you ever read a poem to him or in front
of
him?
Oh, yeah, a couple of times. And in my 5th book, which is called The Gone and the Going Away, there's a poem called The Debt. And it's very much acknowledging the debt I felt to my father. And I think the first line of that poem is, my father rode a horse to school. And it goes on from there. And I read that at a bookstore in Lexington when the book came out, and my dad was able to sit right there. And I got pretty choked up reading that to him. And he appreciated hearing it, but I don't think he ever went back and read it.
You mentioned earlier about wanting to make sure you went back to the land. How did that happen, and where are you now?
When I learned my first book was going to be published, I said to myself, if I make any income at all from poetry, I'm going to use it to buy land in Kentucky. And I've never made any money from book sales, but I do get some nice additional income from going and giving readings and little weekend teaching projects and things like that. And so anytime I do that, I've saved the money, and about a year after my first book came out, I bought a 20-acre farm in Washington County, Kentucky, that had an old farmhouse on it that really wasn't habitable at the time. So I used my summers and spare time to get it livable.
And that land, I know the British documentary that I saw on you, you're walking out through there and you're naming every tree and every bush and every animal there. Obviously, you know that place intimately. Is that where you do your work mostly, kind of walking through those woods?
Yes, I as I've said to some people, it took me a while to realize that when I bought these 20 acres, I wasn't exactly buying prime farmland. I was buying pretty scrubby, rugged, knobby land that had the topsoils pretty well depleted. In the few flat places we have, I've had to really amend the soil, and we'll have to keep doing that. And it allows us to have pretty nice gardens every year. But I like to say we raise squash, tomatoes, and poems at our place.
As you're walking out in the fields or whatever, and you might get an idea, how do you capture that? Do you have a notebook with you? Do you count on your memory? What do you do?
I typically just count on my memory. And I'd say probably earlier in my writing days, walking into the woods, I was most interested in some sort of visual detail, the slant of light coming through the vertical trees, and the contrast of that, so that kind of visual detail, or something floating in a pool of the stream. But in the last few years, three years at least, I've been a lot more interested in sound. And so I find myself going into the woods to see what is there to listen to.
Now, why has that changed, do you think?
Our language is built of sounds. And in particular, the language that works well for poetry is the language that we have for the physical world and our physical actions. So like snap, you can snap your fingers, a twig can snap, you can make a snap decision. So it's a word that kind of can be applied with different shades of meaning, but it's also almost an onomatopoeic word. And it's a pretty basic word too. It's not Latinate or anything like that. It's a very concrete Germanic sounding word. And so I've been trying to make use of that kind of language in my writing. And to reinforce that, I've been listening to the sounds of the world, particularly the world in the woods.
And do you feel like you've sort of trained yourself to be more aware of those things than you were
Yes.
when you started?
I mean, some of this stuff, I expect you can determine this, and perhaps your listeners too. This stuff can become pretty obsessive. There are just certain sounds. You may have heard this yourself. For instance, the last few weeks we've had a pretty dry spell. It's been we finally got rain yesterday and today, but for probably 6 weeks we didn't have any measurable rain. It was very hot. And the trees were losing their leaves, not because the leaves had turned, but because everything's so dry. And you can hear when the stem of a leaf breaks itself off from a branch. It's just a very particular sound. And there's no other sound that's like it, as far as I can tell. And things like that, it just makes me grateful to be able to be in a place to pay attention to that kind of reality.
You know, as I'm sure you well know, there's a long line of writers and poets who have sort of defined themselves by their descriptions and interpretations of the natural world. You know, I know a lot of people read Thoreau in high school and college. Obviously, Wendell Berry, one of your compatriots there in Kentucky, is well known for it too. In a time when environment, certainly that natural world around us, seems more peril than it used to be, do you see some responsibility in yourself to try to tell other people sort of the wonders of the natural world around them?
Oh, yes. I've said to my students in the last few years, particularly 18, 19, 20-year-olds who are encountering a world that seems so divided and imperiled, and many of my students are functionally illiterate when it comes to the natural world. And I say, you all can learn this. You can learn the trees. You can learn the birds. You can learn wildflowers. And it's thrilling to just go out in the woods and say, yep, that's a red oak, or that's a pawpaw. I've suggested to my students that on their own, that they get a couple of handbooks, and over the next few years, they just go out where they can and learn how to identify 25 species of tree by the leaf, and then identify 25 species of songbird by the song. So all you have to, certain birds like a gnatcatcher or something like that, that small bird, and they're in the very tops of trees when the leaves are on, so it's pretty hard to see one, but you can sure hear one. And there's just something that is affirming about being able to hear a bird call and know, yes, that little peep is a gnatcatcher. And then I'd extend it and say, learn the watershed you live in and all the tributaries of it. And my theory about that is not anything sophisticated, that if we educate young people to know the details of the world we actually live in, then they're going to be in a better position to take care of it.
It seems like the poet's role has sort of changed so much over time, or at least the time we know about. You know, poets used to be sort of the newscasters of their day, way back when, going from town to town and in verse explaining to people what was going on. Shakespeare wrote in iambic pentameter, and people would come to the theater to see him, and all these different things. And I just wonder, kind of in the 21st century, in this weird word-flooded world we live in sometimes with tweets and all the things that are going on, what do you see as the poet's job? What's your job?
Let me answer that by saying what I think the poet's job is not. As much as we as a culture may seek it, I'm less comfortable with the idea of the poet as a kind of soothsayer, because that means that there's a person who has the answers. while sometimes that might be desirable and sound good, I think if we're going to find answers, we have to do that work together. But I do think a poet is in a position to ask certain questions or imply them. And maybe a poet can make a sharper distinction between human responsibility to each other and to the world we live in. I think one of the things I try to do is just acknowledge that whatever thought we may have, whatever action we may have, it's happening in this green world. And we are foolish to think that we can cut ourselves off from it.
Morris, would you like to, do you have another poem you'd like to read for us?
Sure. I think this is a poem from later in Rail Splitter called The Audience. Who are you people anyway? Does hearing my voice from the dead disturb you? You're probably wondering what to make of this performance. I wonder too. But it doesn't matter to me. I'm dead as words writ on the page. You have to find the life in them. That is the pleasure of listening to a voice on the stage or reading a book. There's something alive you bring to life by being the reader or seeing the show, and that makes being alive less lonely. All of this expression has been for you. I beg your pardon, I had to pause for a moment to think of the proper word. I expect you know how difficult it is to get the words just right. Expression is too precise. It's better to think of this as a series of notes and meditations which, by nature, are incomplete. One of the things you have to accept in life and art are the parts left out, the missing pieces, and the simply inexplicable. What's missing says something by being absent. It is a gesture of the mind to leave it out, and then the gesture of another mind to grasp the absence. But once the absence is grasped, it becomes a complicated emptiness. To fill it, we have the stage and books. But increasingly, I find that musing on the emptiness is pleasant enough, as when looking over a landscape one can see where a tree has been, even a wilderness, and contemplate what might have happened and imagine why. What else do you want from my countenance, from my exhausted face staring out?
Morris Manning, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tommy. It's been a real pleasure. I appreciate it.
That sound you hear is the call of the gnatcatcher, one of the birds Morris Manning talked about when he was talking about his walks through the Kentucky woods. I imagine he could have recognized that call, the same way he could have identified the leaves on the trees and the flowers on the forest floor. I've often thought that most poets and painters and musicians don't have any special gifts that other people don't have. The difference is that they pay attention. We live in a world where people brag about multitasking, where many of us live vicariously through our phones instead of out in the world. It's so hard just to look around and be quiet for a minute and absorb the beauty around us. A poet is an explorer, sending back dispatches from undiscovered countries, even if the countries happen to be right there on our street or just a few steps out in the woods. We need those explorers more than ever. Our bodies and our minds don't travel the way they used to, but they still can. Now, for just a few seconds, listen to the gnatcatcher. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where we have show notes for each episode with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.